There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world to come and don't you see?
Hello there, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Rick Spezak, your host at Progressive News Network. I wanted to bring you the full interviews with both Emeny Dillick and Dennis Campbell. They are two exceptional people, both of them fine progressive webcasters in their own right. And I wanted you to meet them. I wanted you to hear the full details of what they did. We had a brief segment of their interview yesterday on the Sunday show. But here's the editorials in full. First, we've got Emeny Dillick of Progressive Press. And then we'll have Dennis Campbell of both UK Progressive. He's the publisher and senior correspondent. And also he's producer and host of The Three Pundits, The Three Muckrakers, available on iTunes. So here we go. This is Emeny Dillick from Progressive Press, based in Madrid. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Miss Emeny Dillick, publisher, author, essayist, raconteur. Emeny, welcome to the show. What's new with you?
Thank you. Always a pleasure. Everything is good. Everything is going well. How is everything with you?
Things are going pretty good, dear. Now, you're going to give us a report from España. Now, are you Madrid-based or Barcelona? I forget.
I'm in Madrid.
Madrid.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Se puede.
Yes, podemos, actually, podemos. We can talk about the good things that are happening in Europe, as we were just talking about before the show, that, you know, we always hear about these horrible things happening around the world, but there are some good changes happening, too. So, of course, time will tell if it's going to be for the better or if they're going to be successful at what, you know, idealistically they're trying to do. But we can talk about it. And where do you want to start with? We can start with Greece or Spain, because what happened in these two countries is very similar.
Right.
So we can generally talk about the situation, why they were in this place, what happened to them, and then what are the you know, the new parties are doing. So whichever.
Well, let's start with Greece, and then we'll work our way back to Spain. Okay. What are you hearing? What's going on? What do you hear about things going on in Greece and, of course, the negotiations?
Sure. Well, the negotiations, they just actually today I just read it in The Guardian and Telegraph that they just signed up the new negotiations for another terms of the bailout, that they were receiving support money, funds, but they were trying to negotiate the terms. So they kind of, I guess, found a middle way. So it's good in a way that they're not going to be out of funds, so they're still going to be able to pay their people, workers, and at least the public sector workers. So that was good. The finance minister says they just want some time, and then so they can implement what they want to do, actually. But they've been going through a very, very tough time. The finance minister, I am having a hard time pronouncing their names.
Uh-huh.
Interesting. Yanis Varoufakis. I'm just going to go like that.
That sounds good.
He's a pretty brilliant man. And he was saying that, I've been, you know, listening to his TED Talks and reading about him.
Uh-huh.
He was saying that Greece is going through its Great Depression, basically, very similar to what we went through in 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, their economy is suffering. And so that's one of the reasons that were a push for early elections in January. So January 2015, this new party, Syriza, came to power. Alexis Tsipras is the new prime minister, and then they are a parliamentary republic, so it's that they have the president and the prime minister, and very similar to what we talked about before to Turkey. The president, Carlos Papoulias, basically have just a more of a ceremonial role, and prime minister makes the most decisions with its cabinet.
Okay.
So what happened with Eurozone? I'm just going to go over real quickly with the financial meltdown.
I think you should, because not everybody follows European news very closely. So go ahead. A thumbnail would be fantastic.
Okay. So these things that happened with Spain, Greece, Portugal, Ireland, basically, and Cyprus, very similar situation. And I'm going to tell you why it happened, it started, and then the reasons. There are little differences between individual countries, but generally same reasons. So Eurozone debt crisis started right after the U.S. 2008 financial meltdown. And, you know, I know I explained to you what happened to us, you know. The problem is because the U.S. economy, economic relationship with the EU is the largest and the most complex in the world. I mean, there's like a $2.7 billion services trade flows about each day between EU and U.S. So what happens in the U.S. directly affects the EU economy. So after the financial crisis in 2008 in our country, it started basically roll over to Europe. So by 2009, these countries with the shaky economies basically blown away.
Uh-huh.
And they got into such a panic, the European the Monetary Fund, European Central Bank, European Union. So they get together, which they're called Troika. Troika means any committee that has three members. It's a Russian word, but this is European Central Bank, European Union, the government, and the International Money Fund together. So these three came together and they say, okay, don't panic, we'll help you to these countries. They say, we're going to bail you out, but in order, you know, to get these money, we have to implement strong, strong austerity measures in exchange for the bailouts,
right?
So these measures are basically including mass layoffs of public sector workers, sale of public resources like government-owned port facilities, and high taxes. So this implemented this in Spain, Greece, Cyprus. Unfortunately, they're not working. So people suffered, and economies in these countries shrunk further, and therefore people started to rise up saying, you know, listen, we're losing our pensions, we're losing our jobs, we're losing our homes, and this is not working. These measures need to stop, and you have to come up with different solutions. Okay. One thing I want to clear, especially for Greece, everybody says that, the Greece got into, you know, government was spending so much because it's a welfare country, it's a welfare state. And that's actually a myth, because most of the government spending in Greece was military spending. And this is so interesting, Rick, because I knew about this because I'm originally from Turkey. So we have this love and hate relationship between Turkey and Greece. So I knew about their military buildup, but when I look through the U.S. media and when I look through traditional, no mention of the military spending. And I was thinking, but they're just a population of just 11 million people. They're the largest importer of conventional weapons in Europe, Greece. And they rank fifth in the world behind China. So their military spending is the highest in the European Union. And nobody mentioned that. I mean, they spent so much money on ships, and this was a major, major factor behind their national debt. So military spending, just like we do in the U.S., you know, close to 60% of our federal.
I was reading some analysis that was saying that the new Greek government wants to back off all of that military spending. And that they're being pressured by the Europeans, probably because the sales are coming from there, to keep that spending going. And
correct.
That, as you said, is a large part of their debt.
Very large, largest part. Actually, Germany were selling ships, warships, and the U.S. sold them F-16s, of course, and France sold them a lot of weapons. So, and there are still current agreements, sales agreements. So the current the new government, they're trying to, you know, back off from those, of course. Actually, the prime minister said, we don't want to buy F-16s, we want to buy ambulances. So that basically, do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
He basically saying that our military spending is enough. We already have a large enough, you know, and they belong to NATO. So if something happens to them, they already have NATO to help them. If anybody, for example, if Turkey, which Turkey has really no intentions of doing it, but in
right.
case if there is a problem and then Turkey attacks them, they have the entire NATO supporting them. So it's not going to, they don't really need to worry about spending any more than they already have on military. But it's very similar, you know, this is typical neoliberal policy, very similar to what we do in U.S. 60% of our federal budget goes to, you know, military spending. So that was a major, major problem in their deficit, but people don't, you know, the media, they just didn't cover that. So the second issue is the major corruption. There is a corruption, bribery, money laundering, and tax evasion. And rich people and corporations, basically, just like in the U.S., they didn't pay any taxes.
We've heard this problem before.
Only small businesses and then the working, you know, people were paying. I don't know if you heard of the Lagarde list, the famous list of close to 2,000 tax evaders.
Uh-huh.
So there was this guy, I forgot his first name. His last name is Falciani. He used to work for HSBC. This is one of the largest banks in the world, Europe and the U.S. So this dude found out that over 130,000 rich people and organizations were hiding taxes. So he took this list and he decided to sell the list to the relating countries. For example, he went to the Greece and said, here, this is the list of the people that are evading taxes and you can, you know, do whatever needs to do to get your money from these people, taxes.
Right.
But you know what happened?
Nothing.
Nothing happened. Nobody did anything. So the famous Lagarde is, Ms. Lagarde is the IMF leader, head of IMF, International Money Fund. She received this list of the Greek, the tax evaders that in Greek, close to 2,000 people on
right.
the list. And so she basically tried to get the Greek government at the time to do something with it, but again, nothing happened. So there was a massive, massive tax evasion and corruption. As a matter of fact, the country is so corrupt that the 2010 Corruption Perceptions Index, that's an organization that said through Transparency International does that.
Yeah.
Transparency International grade Greece at worst place in comparison to any South European equivalent, due to exceptionally high corruption. So, government spending on military, corruption, tax evasion. On top of it, they had unregulated and inefficient banking systems, both countries, Greece and Spain.
Let me make one other point that I think people may not fully appreciate.
Okay.
When it is said that the government has been bailed out, what they're really saying is that the
bank
just correct. Like in the U.S., it was the bankers that got bailed out
correct.
Once again.
Correct. Correct. So it's when they say government, it's actually government is borrowing money, getting under more debt to bail out the banking system. So the banks get the money. The worst part is actually, you know what's in Spain? They had the same real estate bubble that we did, at least in the U.S. I mean, I'm not looking for a silver lining. I'm just comparing. When you lose your house, say that you couldn't pay your mortgage because you purchased a home that you should have never purchased in the first place and it
right.
was overvalued, whatever. But say that you lost it because of the bubble, real estate bubble burst, and you lost your home, but at least you don't need to pay the mortgage payments afterwards because the house is the collateral, bank takes the house, and that's it. But in Spain, even after they take your home away, you still have to continue to pay the mortgage.
Oh, my.
And that, can you imagine? I mean, in Greece, there was a 50% increase in male suicides because of the economy. I mean, it's a disaster. These people are suffering. So the inefficient and unregulated financial banking systems in both countries, on top of it, the real estate bubble burst. And so they faced very, very similar things. One thing I want to mention in Greece, that when they were trying to get into the European Union, they entered in Eurozone in 2001. So in order to be a member of the Eurozone, countries have to meet a specific requirement.
Right.
They are called a Maastricht criteria. It's a treaty that's signed. It basically says that countries need to have sound fiscal policies before entering the EU, and their debt limit needs to be 60% of GDP, and annual deficits no greater than 3% of GDP. So when Greece applied, they were trying to get into the European Union, they realized that, of course, they were not matching this requirements of the treaty, financial treaty. You know what they did? They
yes.
hired our lovely Goldman Sachs from Wall Street to help them out, to cook their books.
Yep.
So what Goldman did, they kind of took over their accounting, and they taught them how to hide their deficit, budget deficit, and borrowing levels to meet that treaty to get in. So at the end, basically, they did get into the European Union with a faulty, you know, economy. It wasn't correct. It wasn't a good economy to get in. And Greece paid Goldman Sachs and other banks for that
pleasure,
cooking the
yeah.
books, millions of dollars in fees.
Yeah.
Millions.
There's an echo in this economic reality, isn't there?
Can you imagine how and people are aware of that? You know, Greek people, even though it's a small country, they're well educated and they're aware of the situation. So, of course, they rose up. Of course, they started to protest. I mean, I really understand that they understood what's going on. So, from all this situation that was going on, the left organizations on the left and some smaller parties, they decided to get together, and they called this created this coalition called SPACE, and that organization, basically it's the participating parties or the organization that worked together, created Syriza. So Syriza actually, it's not one political party, it's sort of like a coalition
uh-huh.
of the left in Greece. A lot of people don't know that. So they're all these organizations, civil organizations, the workers' rights organizations, and they got together to create this coalition, and then it turned into a political party, and they have basic the principles that they want to follow under. For example, the first one is of course, against the neoliberal reform of the pension and social security system. So they want to fix that first. And they have this anti-terrorism legislation, which is so strange. It's very similar to what's going on in the U.S., trying to turn the country into a police state. So they are opposing to that. Basically, they want to go through the they also want to review the role of European Union and redetermine Greece's position on it. They didn't exactly say that they want to leave European Union, they don't want to, but they just want to work around the conditions of how much power the EU organization has on their economy or has on their internal works of the country. So so they did come to power, and an emergency election January of this year, and so far they seem to be doing well, and they just yesterday renegotiated the last bailout, and then they're getting a little bit more money, but I don't know exactly the conditions of it, but so they want to get rid of the austerity measures. They want to stop privatization, which is that actually caused a little bit of rift between IMF, because the first thing was that one of the harbors they decided to stop the privatization, the sale of it to China. So they don't want to privatize all public sector institutions. And that caused a little bit of a problem because as you're aware of it, the IMF really into privatization of everything, including even the schooling and, you know, healthcare. And Greek people are against that. They do still prefer, they want free healthcare and they want free education. And but we will see. They have a 4 year to go.
I think if they could figure out a way to bill us for the air we breathe, they would do that too.
Correct. Just like Nestle was saying, the CEO of Nestle saying that the water is not a human right.
Right.
You know, they were trying to charge for water too. So soon they will charge us for the air too. So, I mean, I'm hoping they will be successful because it's going to be a massive, massive change. I mean, we're talking about decades and decades of neopolitical policies, economic push on these countries. So we'll see how it's going to work out. They sound very idealistic. They're younger, well-educated, and they have really strong support in their countries. I mean, people seem like they really understood what happened to them. So just even the wordage, you know, like neoliberal policies, people use that on their pancards, on their signs when they're protesting. I don't see this in the U.S. Like even with my liberal friends, when I talk to them about neoliberal policies, finance, you know, economic policies, they don't really, they say, are you talking about capitalism? What are you saying? So it's a, I think maybe we need to educate the public in the U.S. as well on that, as far as, you know, unregulated business, no taxes of large corporations only, and no workers' rights. All those things are basically neoliberal policies, and we need to understand that. So same thing happened in Spain, but good things are happening in Spain too. And there is a new political party called Podemos, which means we can. So it's similar to Obama's
slogan. Yes, we can. Yeah.
But they said they have no connection to Obama. He was the Pablo Iglesias is the leader of the party, elected leader. He was on Democracy Now recently, and I listened to him, and he was very adamant about that. He's like, no, we have no connection. No disrespect to Obama, but we really don't have any connection to the U.S. on that part. They just came out with that. And
I
want to mention one thing about Podemos that I liked.
Please do.
That they started from this ground movement of indignados, which they were very similar to Occupy Wall Street people, the youth movement that we had in the U.S. And they successfully turned that movement into a political party, which doesn't happen often. Like in Turkey, we had the Gezi Park protest, but people couldn't get that movement going into and move it into actual political arena. So they were successful on that, and they did very well. They became the second, third largest party within the first 10 days of they declare themselves as a party. So and now they're the second largest party in Spain in the polls. So I have a feeling they will win this upcoming election next year.
Wow.
So yeah, and they sent about five representatives to European Union's elections. So they're doing well too, and very similar policies with Syriza. They're against austerity measures. They are for free education and free healthcare, and you know, they want to get rid of corruption, anti-corruption policy
uh-huh.
they have. So and they also want to regulate the banking system. So I'm hoping, you know, they can work together. We'll see.
One of the interesting things I think that has come from this Greek financial crisis and negotiation is there's been a dialogue started. The Greek financial minister doing the negotiations with the European Commission had an essay that I just recently read, and he was really drawing a parallel that this problem is not just a Grecian problem. This problem is a European problem and even a broader problem. How do liberal democracies, so-called, work in an economic environment? Capitalism has its flaws, and this situation really kind of establishes in pretty clear, defined terms, you know, does what part does governments play? How does this work with the free enterprise thinking? Clearly, unregulated capitalism has a real major human deficit in it, and this kind of really raises in really sharp detail, you know, when the finance people want to cut all the benefits and cut all the wages and cut all the social services, what civilization results from that kind of thinking? And I think that in a way, this has really done a great service, not just if this negotiation helps the Greek people, but it, you know, really raises the issue across Europe and even across the big water here.
Correct. And on top of it, these banks, for example, Wall Street, gambling with people's earnings and the pensions and retirement accounts. So when there is no regulation, there is no limit or control, people, I mean, not everyone in banking are as ethical as we as we would like them to be.
Oh, say it's not so.
Yeah, and when the greed and the money comes in, and I was reading, I was fascinated by Wall Street meltdown, and I was reading how much they corrupted themselves and how comfortable they were with just, you know, using people's pensions money to gamble, knowing these accounts, they were selling these faulty mortgages, they knew they were bad.
Absolutely.
And they still sold it. So it's very mafia-like when I think about it. It's very corrupt. It's corrupt to its core. So I think maybe, like you said, well, the guy, Greece's finance minister said, I read that article that you're talking about. He says, I wonder if it was in that article or maybe in a talk lecture I listened. He says, we're going to crush oligarchy. So we'll see. We'll see how successful they will be, because it's so entrenched. It's so powerful at this point that the systems, you know, banking system and their backers and the military is so powerful that I don't know if this little country and Spain together maybe will be able to, because I don't know about France. France, I'm not sure. And Germany is definitely, you know, Merkel is not going to go left like these people. So I don't know if they'll be successful, and I'm really rooting for them, because we need to be on the side of the working people. We need to be on the side of the truth and facts, and they need to get rid of the corruption and tax evasion. We have massive problems with that in the US, so you know.
Sure.
I mean, billions and trillions of dollars.
Well,
only,
you know,
really the working people pay taxes, because
that's
they're
right.
able to
that's right.
see, you know, and the small businesses, and that's it. You know.
I asked my my own accountant one night on the heels of the Enron scandal, where they sold their own debt to themselves. I said, hey, can I sell my debt to myself and make a profit? He said, no, Rick, I wouldn't go that way.
Yeah.
That brings me up another issue in Europe that I'd like to see you weigh in on. More and more people are concerned about the issues raised in Ukraine. And further, and the fallout from that, this antagonism of Russia, and you know, we're hearing things like Russian warplanes showing up in the Caribbean, Russian warplanes off the coast of Britain, Russian airplanes off the coast of California, and you know, it only goes to show if we, the West, I mean, if the West is pushing and pushing and pushing on the borders of Russia, who should be surprised that they're doing the same thing in reverse, that they're showing the flag off the coast of Latvia? What are you hearing from the people you talk to in Europe about the Ukraine situation and where that's the trouble that's giving to the West?
Well, the first thing is, again, we're not hearing exactly what's happening in Ukraine.
Of
that's
course.
That's the massive problems. We're only hearing the part that our media wants to show us.
Right.
And the Russia is the big bad guy, and they're trying to invade Ukraine, and we need to help them. But in reality, within the Ukraine, there are some groups that want to separate. And that's always, of course, what we use to get them separated. And the original crisis started, as you know, when the president, prime minister at the time said he wanted to rethink of getting into EU, and then there were some other treaties with the US that he was not very comfortable. So, and NATO, yeah, he wasn't sure if he wanted to get Ukraine in NATO. And then once he just said, I am not sure about this, then the whole thing blew. And then we started to get involved. And you know about the fuck EU video
with our
defense department lady. And so it's like we were involved. I mean, since Ukraine became independent, we were involved with that country. We spent close over $6 or $9 billion supporting the pro-democracy. When you hear this, just pause. Pro-democracy movements and organizations in their country, right?
Yeah.
So suddenly these pro-democracy people were against the person who were democratically elected.
Right.
Suddenly they're like, we want more democracy. We want more freedom. And then, Russia was not going to allow that, because Russia has so much financial interest in that country that we knew they were going to get involved. So the whole thing blew on our face when we decided to support covertly to pro-democracy people, which ended up being like fascists and neo-Nazis. And so the current situation is everybody's fighting with each other. And there are other factions within the country also want to separate. They're separatists within the separatists. Want to create little, it's very similar to Yugoslavia situation.
Yeah.
They're trying to create their own little countries. And so that's causing more problems. And then some of them are getting help from Russia. Of course, Russia is helping them.
Sure.
Militarily, funding. And then the other ones, the right wing, are getting help from us, covertly or overtly.
Right.
And then innocent people are being killed,
as always,
and none of this is notified or like on the news for us, because we only listen to Russia, bad Russia. Russia is trying to invade Ukraine, and that's really not the full case of it. I mean, Russia is going to get involved, and they'll probably get more involved, but it's not the full case. I mean, we need to also learn about our involvement in it and what with it. With the, Viktor Yanukovych, the way he was elected and then, toppled. Why? And how these organizations got support, the opposition organizations that actually uprised. So we need to learn the facts of that, too.
I don't know if you heard, but one of the stories that did leak out about the Ukraine is that the vice president's son is now a very important person in the fracking industry in Ukraine.
Correct.
And isn't that nice? It reminded me of the invasion of Iraq, where they let the weapons caches stand, but they went and protected the oil ministry. It's just staggering how this stuff goes on. Emine, let me ask you another question. We've talked about Europe, but we haven't talked too much about Turkey lately. What's going on in Turkey? What should we know?
Well, the last thing, which is the horrific thing that I learned and kind of shook the country to its core. And there are a lot of protests on the streets. That what happened since the AKP government, the conservative Erdogan's government, took over about 12 years ago. Violence against women skyrocketed in the country. I mean, it was, it has always been a very patriarchal, you know, macho kind of culture, but the actual violence was not as bad as currently it's happening. And last week, a 20-year-old student, young girl, goes into this minibus to go to her house after school, and the minibus driver took her and tried to rape her and then killed her when she resisted and then burned her and then threw her on a ditch, and then her body was found like 3 days later. And so everybody was very upset about that. But people were asking me about this. They're like, you don't have any laws to protect this woman. What's going on? What people don't understand, when you don't live in a country from outside, when you check the Turkish constitution, laws are in place. They are in place to protect. I mean, we have strong, good laws, but the enforcement is not there.
Yeah.
The one of the huge problems is that it's not enforced, and these perpetrators, they get away with very light sentences for many ridiculous reasons that are shown in the court during their trials. And on top of it, the government itself, I mean, the authorities, when they say, for example, when the president of a country says, I don't believe men and women are equal, you know, women are naturally weak, he just said that.
Yeah.
So, Erdogan, I mean, that's, they don't understand sometimes when these statements come out of their mouth, how that affects the entire population. I mean, young boys are hearing this. And the culture itself is already very, very conservative, you know, against women. And so on top of it, when you have this conservative government, just like ours, I forgot his name, there was the GOP representative said the women are the lesser cut of meat.
Yes, I heard that.
Yeah, so it's like these sentences, these statements again and again coming out of the authorities' mouth, and then people are affected by it, even though they think, oh, you know, you're responsible from your actions, you can't be just affected by what I say. But when you're a leader of a country, and when you say men and women are not equal, and then you don't have to do nothing to enforce the laws, I mean, it's blowing on women are suffering. It's a horrible situation, and I don't believe anything will change unless this government goes away. Nothing major will change in Turkey, and it's not only laws, as I said, it's a very cultural, it has to be a cultural shift, starting from very, very young education, from family to school, and all our communities. And then, of course, the laws need to be enforced better. So it's not just only the enforcement of the laws, it's the culture itself. It's too conservative, it's very anti-woman, and there needs to be some major changes in the mentality of this. There needs to be a social shift in thinking about how they perceive women in general, too. So it's that's kind of bad things have been happening in Turkey right now.
Can I ask you about that the June 7th election coming up?
Sure.
It seems that, I don't know if I'm pronouncing the gentleman's name right, Fidan, who was an intelligence person, is now going to stand as an MP. What do you take from that? We've seen CIA people get involved in our government. George Bush Sr. was head of the CIA and then became president. We saw Petraeus fall so rapidly from grace. What does it mean in Turkey?
It's very similar. It's the exact same thing, just like you said. It's the when the intelligence people, just like a CIA being an MP in the U.S., getting involved in a country's government. And this is a very, very shady character. He's not someone that not a lot of people know a lot about him. And he's very secretive. And there were some videotape conversations last year, he was talking about a false flag attack when he was the intelligence chef. And he was talking about a few people in the government, false flag attack, to get Turkey involved, get Turkey into war with Syria. He was saying on the record, he was saying that this was secretly recorded, of course, and it leaked, but nothing happened, as always. He was saying that he could go to Syria, he could send people to Syria, few people, and then they can throw missiles to Turkey from Syria, making it look like Assad did it, so that Turkey can attack Syria. So they're trying to. They were thinking about scenarios about how they can get country more involved in Syrian conflict. So I mean, this is a man I don't think you can trust, and he's very secretive, and he covered his base pretty well. So there are many things other than that video, voice recorded conversations. There aren't much that's out there about him, but maybe eventually once he gets more visible, there'll be more things to be, you know, dug out to find out who exactly he is. And I just sense that he's a very dangerous man and he shouldn't be in any government. But
my goodness, you know, the pressures there with Turkey having such a long border with Syria, you know, it's so troubling to hear that this fellow was involved in at least discussions of a false flag operation. Let's go further south. Let's talk about the instability in Libya. You know, the legacy of the Bush years, the instability in the Middle East, it just, you know, one more, you know, artificial kingdom in dire straits. So what's your take on the situation in Libya with now Egypt getting involved?
Well, we talked about this last time when I was on the show, is, you know, that we're not covering most of what's going on in there. And I always say, we brought, you know, we got rid of the dictator and we brought the freedom for sure. they're so free, they can't take it anymore.
Jeez.
So there are, I believe, it was close to 13 different groups, the Islamic groups, the terrorist groups, that were fighting with each other over there right now. And then there was just, I think 13, 14 hours ago, there was another attack that killed 40 people. So, and within the government itself, the ones that are supporting some of these terrorists, some of these groups that we recognize as terrorists, and then when U.S. and other countries, international organizations, try to tell them that get rid of these people, and within the government, they are supporting these organizations, these terrorist groups, get involved, and then they start fighting within each other. So it's a mess over there. And if Libya falls into the hands of ISIS or ISIS-like groups, I mean, the entire Europe is in danger, because Libya is, you know, on top of Africa, on north, and it's very close to Europe, so it's right across the Mediterranean. And I mean, there are bombing squads right now in they just killed 40 people and wounded dozens in eastern town. And I really don't know what can be done in the country anymore, more than as it seems like as we get more involved, it gets bigger of a mess. So I don't know the solution to it. I can't answer as far as the solution. But the problem is there are more instability. Government is very inefficient, and there are, like I said, at least 13 different terrorist groups fighting within each other. And they leak. They leak from Libya. They go from Libya. Like, for example, in ISIS has a lot of fighters from Libya. And those weapons that we gave them against Gaddafi, when we were fighting against Gaddafi, the weapons that we handed them down, those weapons end up in Syria, and those weapons end up in Iraq, fighting with, you know, killing the Christians and the other Muslims in Iraq and in Syria. So, I mean, it's a big mess that I cannot see what the solution will be at this point.
No.
But the one thing I know is I don't think we should get more involved in it, but I know we will.
You know, with this, you know, Egypt had its revolution, its counter-revolution, its counter-counter-revolution. The generals are back in charge again.
Correct.
Now they're getting engaged in the Libyan situation. Syria is still a fragmentary civil war, again, multiple sides. Now, I just recently was hearing about how the cost of dealing with refugees in Italy is so expensive they can't afford it, so they turn to the European allies and ask for more support, and the net result is a smaller aid and less refugee aid available to those fleeing, you know, the incredible instability in the Arab, you know, Western Arab region. What are you hearing about North African refugees or Muslim refugees in Southern Europe?
Well, in Southern Europe, I there are so many of them, but I know more about what's happening in Turkey. And I know Syria, for example, half of the country, half of the population, I read that somewhere, are uprooted. Can you imagine half of the United States had to leave the country? So that's
incredible.
I don't think we're understanding the how big the problem is. Like, we just don't really see. We just say, refugees. You know, they live in the camps, and once the situation is over, they're going to go back. But it just doesn't work that way. So, I mean, I know that Turkey took over about 2 million, close to 2 million now. And it's not, there are so many problems with it. And we spent billions of dollars. And I don't know the number of refugees that are coming to Europe, but I know that there were in Switzerland, for example, they had to change laws to allow them from, you know, asylum seekers. And then these boat people, you know, the situation, because they try to come through the boats, and so many of them die on the way because it's a horrendous journey. They basically go into these boats, and they spend money, and they give the smugglers, they smuggle these refugees from Syria to European countries. And so that's a different route. That's through the water. And it's northern Syria, the people, they can just walk up to Turkey, and then we kept the borders open for them. But the ones that cannot get there, the further south, close to the water, Mediterranean, they decide, in order to survive, if they could afford it, to give the money to these smugglers, they got into the boats, and then they take the boat to either France or Spain or other countries that they can reach. So it is, dangerous. It's terrible, and it's affecting everybody. It's not just affecting the refugees that are traveling. It's affecting the host countries that are taking them in also. So, if you'd like to help, there are a lot of organizations. UN has a lot of help, but it's a crisis. It's a massive crisis, and about 9 million, 9 million people.
Let me ask you another question about Turkey's relative to this massive instability across the western portion of the Near East. It has been widely reported that there were our favorite terrorists were being trained in southern Turkey. This is the mythical moderate terrorists.
The rebels. They're called rebels. They're called rebels until they turn into terrorists. That's what I saw them.
Well, today's moderate terrorist is tomorrow's bloodthirsty jihadi, I guess. Is there any, what's the public reaction to this? You know, clearly blowback is going to be the name of the game.
You mean the Turkish people?
Yeah.
How they react, people? Okay. See, originally the Turks, we are so used to, because there's always constant problems with during Iraq and Iran war, the 10-year war, we had a lot of refugees running. And then when Saddam decided to chemically, to throw a chemical weapon on Kurdish people, we had a lot of Kurds that came to Turkey to survive, basically fleeing. So Turkey is the southern border of Turkey. It's very porous and open to this. So we're so used to taking in refugees, but I think these last ones from Syria, like I said, half of the country is uprooted, 9 million people, and close to 2 million came to Turkey. I think the the border towns, those small towns, they're sort of overwhelmed. And on top of it, because for when the civil war started and when these refugees started to come, the local news started to report that there were, of course, CIA, M16, all those different, you know, NATO training these people. And there were reports to that. And because people don't just make up these things, they live there and they see it, the local news people. You know, they go into the camps and they speak with these people and they see there are some different elements, different people, some other things are happening. Where did they get the guns? Where did they get the training? You know? So I have reported that was happening. And then that was disclosed after, of course. Now we know that the mainstream media, even New York Times, I believe, and LA Times, they disclosed it, that we were basically, you know, they didn't say NATO, but kind of us training them there with the help of Turkey. And then the funds were coming from GCC Saudis. So it's kind of like a triangle. Funds, money coming from Saudis and GCC, and then training is done in Turkey and Jordan and Lebanon, and then the training is done by CIA and M16 and NATO. So it's and the weapons, of course, are weapons. We are the largest weapon trader, and legally or illegally in the world, the U.S. So most of them are our weapons. So they are trained there, and then originally, like you say, the rebels, freedom fighters against Assad, they were trained and then sent back to Syria. And then in Syria, when they were fighting, they started fighting within each other, Al-Qaeda. And then this ISIS got separated from them. And then they moved to Iraq. And, of course, when they were moving to Iraq with their white shiny tracks, nobody saw them, so they just moved there. And, you know, with our satellites and all our surveillance, we just didn't see them coming. And then ended up with this bloody mess at the moment. I mean, ISIS, but I believe that they are a mercenary army.
Yeah.
And they are there for a particular purpose. And the purpose, I believe, is one, to get rid of Assad. Two is to separate Iraq into three different countries. So there will be Kurdistan established there, which is going to be another Israel, basically, part of, or another Turkey, I should say, kind of like a side ally to the U.S., another little country that the U.S. will help establish this time, and it's going to be a friend to the U.S. So, because we're helping them, we're helping Kurdish people to fight with these ISIS, which we sort of helped create. So,
Well,
and once they will get rid of it, ISIS is not as powerful as the U.S. media portrays them. They are not. They are a bunch of drug using, you know, they're making a lot of money. So they're not really there for to bring the actual, whatever they're saying, caliphate. It's just not going to happen. I mean, the U.S. or NATO or Turkey will not ever allow that to happen. They're going to be done with ISIS once these other goals that are established that are not being talked. They definitely want to get rid of Assad, and they definitely want to separate the Iraq, the three countries. It's going to happen. Once that happens, they're going to go away. Once that happens, you're going to see that ISIS will just be, oh, we got rid of ISIS. We're, you know, done with them.
It strikes me, since we can't even decide what to call them, it's hard to define, much less defeat an enemy. One other thing I want to ask you, and I thank you so much for the time you've given us. It's just remarkable to hear your insight. The last question I want to ask you is this. Right now, the president has asked for an extension of his war powers.
Correct.
And the Republican response in general, I'm going to characterize it in general as, oh gosh, if he'd only asked for more and prosecuted the war in a more robust way, that son of a bitch who's such an overreacher. So they're trying to have it both ways, of course. But the question I want to ask you is, how does that, oh boy, can we have more war, oh boy, can I go make more war, how does that play in European ears, do you think?
Oh, yeah. Well, other than Greece, I guess, because we talked about their military spending, the way they look at defense. Well, they're changing now, so hopefully. But, well, we are a war-making country. I mean, I don't want to say our economy depends on military spending, but because we can definitely do, we can do without wars. I mean, we are a rich enough, large enough country that we do not have to start wars every decade or every two to four years to sustain our economy. So that myth about our economy being too intertwined with military, so we have to have wars, I don't believe that. That's not correct. What is correct is that whoever is making really, really good money from this conflict, they're powerful enough to push our country again and again into these bloody, bloody conflicts. So it is about money to me. It's not about bringing them freedom. It's not, mostly it's about money. Secondly, it's about geopolitical control of the region and resources, natural resources. But they're all connected. So the natural resources, say it's about petroleum and oil and minerals. So who makes money from the oil? I mean, the Iraqi oil. They were saying the Iraqi oil is going to pay. Who made that money? I mean, Halliburton made money from the Iraq war and oil companies that got the contracts from Iraq. So not the American people, not us, not you and I. So, you know, basically large corporations, military, and Pentagon, and the people that are making the decisions on making these wars and creating these conflicts are the ones that are benefiting, and we're the ones that are suffering. And our money, our tax money, instead of going to free college education, free healthcare, our tax money going to all these defense spending. So I believe we can stop it if we have the right president, if we have the right government. We can stop this, but as far as the President Obama, his foreign policy and military actions, I mean, it wasn't any more different. It wasn't different than Bush. I mean, okay, he didn't really invade a country, but when you look at Libya, when you look at Syria, who we supported, how we fund them, how we arm them, it's and the drone policy. I mean, I don't see a huge difference between conservatives and Democrats, to be honest with you, when it comes to foreign policy. And really, who makes our foreign policy behind closed doors? CIA's budget is classified. We don't even know where, you know, how much money CIA is spending on these operations, and we can't ever check. So, more power for who? It's not for American people. More power for war, more power for military action. It's not the American people. It's not, we're not the ones getting the power. We're not the ones getting the benefits from this military action. So we need to check who is the beneficiary, who we need to follow the money. We need to follow who makes the most, you know, who benefits the most from these conflicts. And then we'll understand. We'll understand why it keeps happening.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Emily, so that people can find out more about the work that you do and your writing, how can they get in touch with you? How can they get in touch with your excellent progressive news?
Thank you.
What's the best way to get for people to learn more about the work that you do?
Excellent. Thank you. We have a Facebook page. It's called the Progressive Press, and they can just type that and get in. And we also have our website, theprogressivepress.net, which we are in the process of updating. And then, of course, they can always find me, Emine Dilek, and I update my personal page daily on news from Ukraine to Libya to Syria and Caucasus, Russia, all that area. The only areas that I don't really cover is South America and further south of Africa and Australia. Those are the areas I don't have much information. But the rest, Middle East, you know, Turkey, Europe, especially now. And I would love questions too. You know, if anyone has a question about they don't understand, they're confused about what happened, like you asked about Ukraine, I'll be happy to do more research and learn more about it, which challenges me and helps me, and I love that. And thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure always. You just keep doing the wonderful things you do. Thank you so much, Emily.
Thank you. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Don't forget, you can always go to averyvoice.com and get links to our guests, to the work that they do, to their publications, I hope you take advantage of that as well. I also want to support our good friends and fellow progressive broadcasters, Gwen Holden Berry and her show There Be Monsters, Brian Stetton and his show Progress Toward Democracy, Sita Baguil and her show Sita Media, Susan Nylon and the Nylon Report, Anita Stewart and her show Wise Women. These are all great progressive broadcasters. I hope you check them out. And I also want to play one of the Unsung Heroes pieces before we get on to Dennis. So here is the story of Fannie Mooney. Here we go. From Unsung Heroes by Joanne Foreman.
Even before America existed as a nation, working people struggled to better their lives, and that always included women. Fannie Mooney was born in New Orleans in 1872. She married a garment worker named Charles Sellens, and after his death, she took up his trade in a shop in St. Louis to support her four children. She later moved to Chicago, where she helped organize the United Garment Workers of America. Her organizing ability led her to the United Mine Workers in the West Virginia coal fields. Her organizing efforts there landed her in prison, though a huge campaign led to her being pardoned by President Woodrow Wilson. In 1917, Fannie Sellens moved to the Pennsylvania coal fields. Despite the violently anti-union climate, she was able to bring thousands of mine workers into the union. She became the heart and soul of the mine workers' union movement in the Allegheny, thus earning the undying hatred of the bosses. Like her contemporary Mary Harris Mother Jones, Fannie Sellens knew that the union movement could not survive without the backing of women. After all, they and their children suffered along with the men. Then and now, a strike meant great hardship, and Sellens was well known in very many miners' households. There was no safety net at all at that time, and Fannie Sellens had to help find clothing, heat, medical care. The coal mine operators made no bones about their fervent desire to get rid of Fannie Sellens. On August 16, 1919, they got their chance. The miners were on strike. Sellens was with the strikers on picket duty when they were attacked by deputies and company officials. One striker was shot as Fannie tried to shepherd children out of the way. She then tried to stop the goons who were clubbing the downed striker. The company official yelled, "Kill the bitch!" They shot Fannie Sellens three times, and as she lay on the ground, one of them fired a shot directly into her head. Nobody was ever arrested for her murder, much less convicted. In addition to her direct work with labor organizing, Fanny Sullins taught immigrants from Eastern and Southern Europe who were flooding into the dangerous mines that they did not have to put up with injustice. In America, she taught, though it was an uphill battle, workers were supposed to be able to struggle for better pay, better working conditions, and a decent respect for their contributions to society. Tune in next time for The Life of Rose Schneiderman. Songs for the Unsung is a project of user-friendly music, script, narrative, and original music by Joanne Foreman, sung by Jenny Bird.
And now, here's the interview with Dennis Campbell, producer and host of Three Muckrakers podcast on iTunes, and also publisher and chief editorial writer for the UK Progressive. Direct to us from Wales in the UK. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Mr. Dennis Campbell, publisher of the UK Progressive, and also producer and host of the Three Muckrakers podcast, featuring Dennis Campbell, Phil Perry, and Dr. Dario Linares of Cornwall. Dennis, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
How's things out your way?
Well, partly cloudy, a little bit chilly, but nothing like what the northeast of the U.S. has been experiencing, for
yes.
sure.
Yes, and all the climate deniers are thrilled to death that it's actually a little cool. Let's talk about the news. There's so many interesting things going on your side of the water. One of the first things I want to mention is that new drilling moratorium in Scotland.
Well, not just in Scotland, it's also in Wales. It appears to be finally slowing down the Tories, which are the Conservative Party. That would be the closest equivalent to the U.S. Republican Party, in their quest for fracking. That plus the fact that it now costs them much more to get that fracked shale gas out of the ground than it will for anything they'd be able to sell it for because of the recent financial collapse of the oil market. So there's a lot of things that have started to move in our favor. And the fact that you have enough people that have been speaking for a long enough period of time about the dangers of unconventional coal gasification or UCG, fracking and hydraulic fracturing, the fact that you're now having earthquakes in your state of Oklahoma, where you never used to have them before, and other hazards that are being noticed in places like Queensland, Australia, where they seem to be trying to frack every last possible open field. A lot of good things are happening in terms of trying to slow this all down.
Yes, that is good news on a couple different fronts. As you know, it's a real mixed story over here. Another thing on the security front I want to mention is that recent revelation of the SIM card hack, where U.S. and U.K. spies have had access to billions and billions of cell phone records, and GCHQ has been sued, and they're going to be forced to provide some information.
Yeah, what a surprise. You know, I don't think anybody at the end of the day is really terribly surprised that the government has access to cell phone records and the ability to hack cell phones. But the SIM card thing, I think, caught a few people by surprise. The government here has come out and said, yes, indeed, we have, improperly, I believe the term is, improperly accessed cell phones from around and conversations from around the globe. And nobody seems to be terribly upset about it. Let's see, it says UK admits unlawfully monitoring legally privileged communications, I think is the headline that was in The Guardian last week.
Yeah.
From MI5. And, we've also had a ruling on the 6th of February that declared the regime surrounding the sharing of mass personal intelligence data between America's National Security Agency, the NSA, and Britain's GCHQ was unlawful for 7 years. So this is not anything that's new news. It's just the fact that it's becoming public that has made it news. And this is one of the dangers that everybody warned about back as far as 2001, 2002, when the Patriot Act passed, that there would be these moments where you had people jumping up and down and saying, yes, I'll gladly give up some of my freedoms to ensure that we are safe. Well, that's not necessarily the case now, is that you've got people that are monitoring conversations, storing data. You've got that huge data collection facility where they literally had to come up with a new term for the size of the data that was going to be stored there. So it's really a very worrying thing. Nothing that you do or say anywhere is privileged anymore. I mean, even your Samsung television set can turn itself on, because of the voice commands.
Hush, honey, the TV's listening.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's truly astonishing the levels upon which one can be eavesdropped. I mean, as I sit here looking at a webcam that, could be switched on and off at any point in time, the camera on my iPad, the camera on my phone, and as well as all of the data listening devices. I mean, there was a time when I was worried somebody might find out my password. It's turning out passwords are absolutely useless anyways.
Yeah, I had an experience yesterday when I went and visited a website that I'd done business with in the past. Now, I didn't log in. I didn't click anything. I just looked at the site, and I got a phone call half an hour later asking if I wanted to purchase their new product. So the level of surveillance, the level of, you will, detection of presence is really beyond most people's imaginings. Another question or another issue I wanted to raise with you is the UK's also admitted recently unlawful surveillance of torture victims and spying on private communication between lawyers and clients. Now, we theoretically have some protections, at least nominally or officially, over here. But it looks like it's been an admitted breach of protocol.
Yeah, that's partly what I was referring to, in the top of this segment, was that, the state is snooping around on legally privileged communication. They failed to comply with several European conventions on human rights, and this comes in advance of a further legal challenge to be heard next month. The security services apparently unlawfully intercepted conversations between lawyers and their clients to provide the government with an advantage in court. Now, that's just absolutely ridiculous. The Investigatory Powers Tribunal, IPT, is going to hear this case, but it's on the behalf of two Libyans, Abdel Hakim Belhaj and Sami El Sadeh, who along with their families were abducted in a joint MI6 CIA operation and sent back to Tripoli to be tortured by Gaddafi's regime in 2004. So, I mean, this is truly outstanding stuff to hear that, that the government was able to listen to their conversations in order to have a better hand in the case itself. I mean, in the U.S., that would be deemed inadmissible. And the question would be, well, how did you, obtain this information, counselor? I mean, it would never make it to the actual courtroom. I mean, indeed, that's why you've never seen any trials against, what's his name, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, KSM, and right, others, because of the manner in which their confessions were obtained. So it's truly astonishing stuff, and I think it's just the tip of the iceberg.
Dennis, I actually have lost track. Now, was that when Gaddafi was our friend and on the payroll, or was that when we declared him an enemy? I forget. Which one was that?
I don't know, man, but he certainly got his in the end.
Oh my.
So.
We won't pursue that particular rabbit hole any further. Let me ask you this. Have you had a chance to see the Laura Poitras Snowden film yet, Citizen 4?
No, they had a showing in London, but I'm about 3 hours from London, and it wasn't one night that I could see it. But it is something that I do want to see.
Yeah, me too.
I understand it's quite extraordinary.
Me too. We spoke briefly about Mother Europe, and let's wander over there for a second and talk about the troubles in Ukraine. How does that look? What are you hearing in the UK?
Well, it's been so badly handled. I mean, you know, the not just the UK, but all of the governments of Europe have basically sleepwalked into crisis here. You know, nobody wanted to stand up to Putin. And now just yesterday, we had some warplanes off the coast of Cornwall down to the south and west of here that were just sort of hovering around and had to be intercepted by UK fighter jets to sort of say, hey, I think it's Putin's attempt to say, don't mess with us. Particularly around Ukraine. And the question now becomes, I mean, who's next? Albania? You know, who's going to be the next country that he's going to make threatening noises towards with their large separatist community? It's not a good situation. It doesn't have an easy answer. So far, the sanctions have done nothing but embolden him. And he seems to be doing reasonably well at home with the polls somewhere around 80% in support of his actions for Mother Russia. So it's perplexing because their economy is in a shambles right now, and the low price for their natural gas is hurting them even more. You know, Germany, of course, is very exposed because of the spigot running into their country, but they've done more to produce solar, wind, and you know, other power sources in the last 4 or 5 years than anybody in Europe. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this all plays out.
And of course, we had a major, the U.S. And the powers that be had a major hand in stirring up this particular hornet's nest with our ambassador's statements about installing a fascist regime in Ukraine, the old famous fuck Europe statement. When they were talking about installing a fascist regime on the edges of Russia. And, of course, that's what in large part precipitated this expansion.
The undersecretary who happened to be in the embassy at that particular point in time, but still it was not a good situation.
Right. So what we see here, and now there's, of course, rumblings. They're talking about there was recently a political mission to Riga, Latvia. They're looking at the Baltic states as, and they're, you know, this guessing game about where Putin is going to expand to. You know, many of us are aware that in the past, merely having a terrible economy is no slowdown for war drums, and that often it's a great misdirection to get your people focused on the enemy outside when what you have is a terrible conditions on the home front.
Well, they're very used to it as well. I mean, you know, they've been dealing with crises and shortages, particularly for the average person. You know, it's interesting, the billionaires and the oligarchs never suffer, but you know, just as you've seen in parts of the Middle East, those that sit at the top of that pyramid do very, very well, and they don't seem to worry too much about anybody else.
Well, as we go south and east, let's talk about the Greek debt crisis and negotiations that are going on. You know, luckily the bankers have all been bailed out. You know, this much we know for sure. And Greece is trying to, with their new government, try to do something for the people, something to help them out through this terrible situation. But we can pretty much guess the bankers will do fine. What are you hearing over there on the crisis talks?
Well, I mean, they're still at an impasse, and I don't think that's going to change anytime very soon. I mean, the interesting party to watch in all this is the new political party that is really an old party, Syriza. I mean, they've never before been able to get any sort of electoral turnout, and basically they've swept to power on the heels of 4 years of crippling austerity there in Greece. And I mean, unemployment rates are somewhere near 30%. You've got pensions being canceled. People can't afford to eat. It's really a very, very serious situation. But you also have a culture there of not paying tax. I mean, they just don't pay taxes for services. They don't see any value in the services, and therefore, you know, they don't see it as their problem. So I don't really know what's going to happen here. You know, the Greek situation has a potential of being a very serious domino for the EU, because they've now emboldened other parties in places such as Spain and even in Ireland and Italy. So you've got four countries that could be moving further away towards the same type of anti-austerity bent as others. So I cannot see this being a particularly good thing for either the European Union, the currency, and indeed the economy of all the nations here.
With the the American Republican, it's hard to know what exactly to call it. I guess the clown car is now, of course, champing at the bit to have another war, although they seem disinclined to let President Obama prosecute it. Are the Tories is interested in a new war against ISIL, ISIS, Daesh, or whatever you want to call it? Are they as enthusiastic about a new war as the Republicans seem here?
It's not even a question of, no, the simple answer is no. You're never going to see the level of, what is it?
Bloodthirsty.
Yeah, you're never going to see the neocon movement here in Europe like you've seen it in the USA. I mean, I watched rather bemusedly the announcement by Jeb Bush to enter the race. And in so doing, he's now caused all kinds of issues here. You need to pause here for a second. I've got to go to the door, mate.
No problem. All
right. Yeah, thanks.
Sarah, would you sign for that so you're still on this interview, okay?
Thank you.
No dog. Just recording.
The level of okay, I'll come back here now.
Go ahead.
The level of bloodthirstiness that happens in the U.S. is not matched in the U.K. at all. You know, there are some people that believe we need to be stronger, but we've got so many other issues that we're concerned about. And I don't know. It's one of those situations where when you look at the cost, you know, the U.S. still bears 80-90%, if not more, of the combat role and everything else. So I don't see the UK anxious to get out ahead of that under any circumstance.
I was wondering, you've got a general election coming up. What issues capture the electorate, or at least the political wannabes over there?
Well, the biggest issue here is the National Health Service. You know, and the second biggest issue then is the state of the economy, the fact that promises were made by the conservative Tories. They promised to basically get rid of the deficit through the austerity. In fact, the deficit has increased. They promised to take care of a number of different issues, and none of their targets have been hit. So the question that is continually raised is one of, okay, well, you didn't do what you said you were going to do. And the standard stock answer from Prime Minister Cameron is, well, you had 13 years of Labour rule. Why would you hand the keys back to them? And he refuses to answer any questions about that. The other issue is this issue of tax. Apparently, Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation, known here as HSBC, have apparently had a tax avoidance scheme, which has been pretty much followed by every one of the richest 6,000 people here in the UK, which is a substantial portion of then taxable income. And that one has caught the Tories quite red-faced, in that this is a scandal that continues to grow. And it apparently was known 7 years ago by the then finance minister and has been pretty much supported by him and the Home Secretary. So it's interesting to see that the impact of businesses not paying the tax they owe, you know, when it is owed. And then the third issue is the NHS itself. Now, that started out as being the biggest issue. But because they've tried to privatize so many parts of the NHS, you now have a situation where the NHS itself is straining under the demands that are there. Now, we have a situation here in the UK, which you don't have in the USA, called bed blocking. And what that means is that Tory cuts have significantly reduced services available to the elderly and the poor, to the extent where these people can no longer get services that they require once they are slated to leave the hospital. So basically, they can't be discharged because there's no way for them to be taken care of. So they end up staying in hospital, blocking beds for truly sick people. And we've been through a horrific flu season as well as the winter season. And that means that delays in places such as A&E, which you would consider to be the emergency room, have grown as well. All of this has happened under the Tories' watch, and it is having an impact. The last poll I saw was last Sunday that showed that Labour is now up 7% in the last opinion polls. And the Conservatives are not only losing to Labour, they're losing to a far right-wing party called UKIP, the UK Independence Party, which is comprised of a bunch of nutters.
Well, goodness knows we have our share of those, that's for sure. Another question I wanted to... Well, demonstrable, isn't it? Another question I wanted to raise with you back on the UK front as we head down to the roundup. It seems that Tony Blair has stepped in a bit of it with this Global Legacy Award from the Save the Children. Can you talk about that a minute?
I'm not familiar with the award, but I'm not surprised that Tony Blair continues to step into it. Tony Blair is only interested in what happens to Tony Blair, and that's been his modus operandi since he left government. Indeed, you know, he did such a poor job of paving the way for his eventual successor, Gordon Brown, that I think he was only in office for less than a year and a half before they were all voted out.
Yeah, it seems that Save the Children's American branch wanted to give him an award, and the UK staffers were absolutely up in arms, and they gathered 200 signatures saying that this was absolutely inappropriate and a betrayal of Save the Children's founding principles and values. it just seems that...
I'm not surprised.
Well, that's my question. Is there anything that these benighted nationalists over here should know about things going on in Europe that I haven't covered? Anything else we should talk about, sir?
No, I mean, I think you did a really good job of covering the high points. I mean, I think our election is going to be relatively significant, even though you don't hear much about it, and the fact that, you know, it will be conducted with each MP spending the equivalent of about $15,000 maximum, you know, on their entire campaign. The campaign's been going on. We know that election day would be the 7th of May, 2015, but nothing has happened, you know, before then. I mean, nothing has happened in terms of, you know, political action committees or millions of pounds being raised by outside interest groups. I mean, the parties themselves have supporters and, you know, who help to fund other parts of their activities, but nothing like what you see. We don't even see adverts. We'll see the occasional party advert, but they all get the same amount of time. I think it's about 5 minutes, and they're able to put together a message. The mailbox here will soon be filled with leaflets. There may be the occasional campaigner coming through here, including the candidate themselves if it's a small enough district, but it's a much different affair than the 2 years that you're going to be spending fending off negative political adverts over who will become the nominee for either party.
Well, I just thought of one other story I'd like you to comment on. You know, many Americans with various axes to grind noticed that terrible attack on Charlie Hebdo, and the odd hypocritical march afterwards in favor of press freedom by a group of world leaders who actually don't support press freedom whatsoever. So it made sense that our president wasn't there. But the fallout, no, not for whistleblowers. I know that you're laughing. The fallout in Britain, is there any call for, a relative understanding of press freedom, the necessity of it? I know you guys don't have a First Amendment like we do, but is there fallout from the Charlie Hebdo incident?
It's almost vanished, sadly. I mean, you know, we had a bit of a resurgence last weekend when the gunman went crazy in Copenhagen.
Yeah.
Killed a few people there and was, the target was, again, one of the cartoonists that had put together images of the Prophet Muhammad. I don't see the press freedom as being a big an issue as the false equivalency, particularly when you look at ISIS and ISIL and, you know, the fact that they support a very pure, if not, you know, third century view of Islam. And what you're seeing happening in the media, particularly in the U.S. media and to some extent here, is this cross-labelization, for lack of a better word, in which you've got, you know, pretty much the use of the term Islam and Muslim being interchanged with terrorists at a very, very alarming rate. You know, what you should be doing is doing the same then with Christianity and the KKK.
Sure.
Because, you know, sure. It's really disgusting, the xenophobia, the Islamophobia that then creates. And I think there's a backlash coming against that much more so than against press freedoms. We've talked about it on the podcast, and indeed, we had Ahmed Tharwat from PBS in Minneapolis. He does a program called Beladan, and he was on episode, I think, number 16 or 17. I think it was in number 17. And because we're all on term break this week, we literally just in the last few minutes, as we're recording this, put up the most recent episode, which is a best of the Three Muckrakers. And we bring back the discussion of Charlie Hebdo, and we also bring back the discussion with Ahmed, because they're very important discussions that aren't being heard right now. And next Friday on the podcast, we're going to have Martin Shipton, who is the chief reporter for the Western Mail, which is a very big newspaper in this country. And we're going to be talking about very specifically press freedoms in the wake of Charlie Hebdo, in the wake of what's been going on in the rest of the world. So it is it's a big topic, at least amongst the media, but not so much amongst the rest of the population.
Yeah, they think they can get along without a free press. They will live to regret that, I'm afraid. But, you know, indeed. Speaking of the podcast, the Three Muckrakers podcast, why don't you tell people how they can get a chance to listen?
Yeah, what I would do is just go to iTunes. Now, it may be, and we think we're listed in internationally in all the iTunes stores, but you may have to come over to the UK store temporarily just to subscribe. I'll send you the link as well.
Thanks,
and
sir.
Perhaps you can pop it on your website.
But I would be honored to.
It's very simple. Just look up. Sometimes it's listed under UK Progressive Podcasts, because it is, when we do post, it goes up under that. But it very clearly will say UK Progressive Podcasts, home of the Three Muckrakers. And we're up to 20, I suppose, and a half episodes at this point, because this is a best of this week. We've been doing this since mid-September, and we're very pleased with it. It's growing very nicely. People are starting to listen and to comment and send us emails and call our lines and chat a little bit more.
And also the UK Progressive, how can people find that?
ukprogressive.co.uk. It's very simple. We've had a huge surge of traffic recently. We've been doing a lot of work with our contributors. We're up to 44 of them, and they do an absolutely superb job of sending articles. I only have to write one piece a week. I remember when we started 8 weeks ago, I was doing, you know, 6 or 7 pieces a day. So it's very nice that we've got this thing that pretty much runs on autopilot these days, because we've got such great contributors out there.
Well, thank you so much, Dennis, for joining us. We really appreciate your perspective from across the pond. This was Dennis Campbell, publisher of UK Progressive and host and producer of the Three Muckrakers podcast. Make sure you tune in. Something definitely worth listening to. Thanks again, Dennis. Bye-bye.
Thank you, sir.
Hello there, good friends. Next thing I want to mention is that Tuesday evening, you want to make sure you check out In the Stream. It's a show produced by our good collaborator, Miss Jessica Dillon Winter. It's always an interesting show. She's an artist and a progressive activist who's been involved in rehabilitation and so many other things. Check out her show if you're an artist, if you're a thinker. Definitely you'll find good things from her show. And I'm going to leave you with one more presentation from Joanne Foreman's Songs of the Unsung. Many of you have heard of the famous Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. Here's a little more information about that. And this is from Joanne Foreman's Songs of the Unsung, Women Heroes.
Here's a song for the unsung working women who worked for America. Here's a song for the unsung. Look, look, Frances Perkins, all on a March afternoon, on her way to a lady like tea.
When the sirens of fire engines tore across Washington Park in New York City's Greenwich Village, it was March 25th, 1911, and the Triangle Shirtwaist Building was on fire. Gathering up her long skirt, Frances Perkins saw that bundles of cloth were sailing from the windows, and then realized in horror that the bundles were 145 people, mostly girls and women, falling to death. It was a scene that Frances Perkins never forgot. Born in April 1880 to a very proper Boston family, Frances Perkins not only had the temerity to be intelligent and questioning, but also committed the unforgivable sin of not being pretty. She was allowed to attend college because it was assumed that she would not marry and would have to earn her own living. She was part of that high-minded generation of women who melded the work of labor organizing with many-faceted social work of the era, settling immigrants, attacking child labor, horrendous working conditions, and the terrible problems of the poor, who, of course, were the people who did the work. Frances did marry, after all, and produce a daughter, but her husband was an alcoholic and spent most of his life in sanitariums and mental hospitals. It is symptomatic that, unlike most women of her time, she kept her maiden name. In 1911, in addition to not yet having the vote, the only road to influence for women was through men. And Frances spent years patiently cementing working relationships with the politicians of the era. Understanding the need to appear non-threatening, she adopted the look she kept from her 30s until her death at 85, modest dresses and suits, dark colors and pearls, always a hat. Her most important contact was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and when he became president, he appointed her the first woman cabinet member in history of the United States as Secretary of Labor. She once said that it should be Secretary for Labor, and in the depths of the Great Depression, with Roosevelt firmly behind her, she wrote the Unemployment Insurance Act, Social Security Act, and other programs we now, hopefully, can take for granted. The atmosphere of the times also promoted union membership, which expanded fivefold during the 1930s. though she cultivated a low-key demeanor, there was one attempt to impeach her, a first for a cabinet officer. It went nowhere, but it did not make her life easier. When Roosevelt died suddenly in April 1945 and Harry Truman became president, she knew it was time for her to go. Her last day was July 1st, 1945. Today, it's not so unusual for women to serve in the cabinet. Frances Perkins paved the way. Tune in next time for the life of Emma Tanayuka. Songs for the Unsung is a project of user-friendly music, script, narrative, and original music by Joanne Foreman, sung by Jenny Bird.
Here's a song for the unsung, working women who worked for America. Here's a song for the unsung.
Well, thanks so much for joining us for this European Report, a special broadcast of Progressive News Network. I'm your host and producer, Rick Spezak. I want to leave you with this dedicated song for the robbers at HSBC. This is Woody. I think you'll recognize
it. It was in the town of Shawnee a Saturday afternoon. His wife beside him in his wagon as into town they rode. There a deputy sheriff approached him in a manner rather rude. Vulgar words of anger and his wife she overheard. Pretty boy grabbed a log chain and the deputy grabbed his gun. In the fight that followed, he laid that deputy down. Then he took to the trees and timber to live a life of shame. Every crime in Oklahoma was added to his name. But a many a starving farmer the same old story told. How the outlaw paid their mortgage and saved their little homes. Others tell you about a stranger that come to beg a meal. Underneath his napkin left a $1,000 bill. It was in Oklahoma City. It was on a Christmas day. There was a whole carload of groceries come with a note to say, well, you say that I'm an outlaw, you say that I'm a thief. Here's a Christmas dinner for the families on relief. Guess it's through this world I've wandered. I've seen lots of funny men. Some will rob you with a six gun and some with a fountain pen. And as through your life you travel, yes, as through your life you roam, you won't never see an outlaw drive a family from their home.
Good night. Thanks. Tune in Tuesday nights to In the Stream with Jessica Winter. And tune in every Sunday for Progressive News Network's Voices of Progressives. Thanks again. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.